Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Jeremy Smith, a United Methodist pastor and creator of the blog Hacking Christianity. Jeremy is the pastor of First United Methodist Church in Seattle, but his wider audience knows him as the prolific writer of blog posts on Hacking Christianity, a site where Jeremy engages others in conversations about faith using the lenses of progressive theology, technology, and geek culture. He's also one of the top go-to sites when folks want to read thought-provoking reflections on the state of the United Methodist Church. In addition to talking about how geek culture and Christianity come together, we also talk about the recent general conference in the United Methodist Church and whether there's hope for our denomination. I hope you enjoy it. Jeremy Smith, thank you so much for being part and coming on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Christian, my goodness, I'm really glad to be here, and thanks so much for your work and your ministry here.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I mentioned in the introduction about Hacking Christianity and the impact that it's had on a lot of folks, particularly in the United Methodist Church, but I've got to start by asking about its origin story and how it all began.
It's the either superhero or supervillain, depending on the audience.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I was a halftime pastor. My first appointment, right outside of Boston, Massachusetts. After graduating from Boston University School of Theology, they'll give me a dollar for mentioning that. And it was a great appointment, and I had a side project that was going on at the same time where I was hosting interfaith conversations anonymously. I had ran an interfaith forum online. Everyone was anonymous. You could ask questions that you know, might seem sacrilegious and have good conversations. And it was a terrific place to learn how to have religious conversations online. Mm. But as I started my first appointment, I felt the need to have my name attached to something so that I was not having anonymous conversations. I was having conversations, you know, where people knew that it was me and that it was less about the safety of anonymity. But what I started the blog as called it Hacking Christianity. Because in grad school, I had written a systematic theology of technology and used technology as a metaphor for the different ways how we craft and create our systematic theology. And I was a geek. I was, you know, into, you know, video games and movies and Marvel and, of course, Star Wars. And so, you know, having a technology metaphor allowed me to have conversations with people who are in geek culture and who were perhaps were less connected to faith. So that's how it began. But then after I started blogging and being out there in the world, it became a... There were very few voices. This was 2008. And so it slowly became, well, I can put my voice out there and why not? So that's pretty well where it started, is that I started it as a side project to have more faith conversations with geek culture, and it ended up being the progressive Methodist culture that ended up being more of my focus.
On the homepage of your blog, you talk about combining progressive theology, tech, and geek culture. So one of the questions I have when you describe yourself as a geek, I'm wondering, how do you answer a self-professed geek who, and I'm sure you've been asked this question a lot over the years, how does Christianity work for them, quote unquote, work for them? Because I would imagine my stereotype is that they may not have a lot of patience for it or interest in it. But what kind of interactions have you had over the years with those conversations?
I think your stereotype is half right, that about half my conversations are with folks that have rejected faith, that do see it as not evidence-based or not convicting to folks who are more steeped in science, more steeped in science fiction, more steeped in creating worlds that that makes sense. And so about half my conversations are with folks who have rejected faith entirely. And so when I use a geek metaphor to talk about faith, it sort of pushes them a little bit to say, oh, well, I'd never really thought about that. But the other half, I think, are people who are more of the ex-evangelicals, like the former evangelicals who have religion has lost its luster to them, and that they see that there's been a lot of things wrong, a lot of, I call them bad hacks, where you try to take something that's good and you tack on something that is bad, you know, or that takes it the wrong way, either whether it's anti-gay theology or anti-women theology, or just bad ways at church planting, you know, which, you know, you all at Urban Village are certainly well acquainted with church planting and the perils and pitfalls around it.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of it is when I talk with geeks that I am presenting the Christian faith as a world, you know, and geeks are used to in worlds, whether it's the world of Star Wars or Marvel or a video game where, you know, there's some loose backstory for why you're shooting other people or, you know, creating these kingdoms of orcs and goblins. And so it's a, and so being able to talk about the narrative and the sort of the world that God creates in our world seems to be the best way I've found to talk about it, whether a person has a faith background or doesn't.
I've got to ask, what's your favorite metaphor? What's your favorite when talking to somebody? Which of the different stories that you know and love do you find is the most effective, whether it come from, as you noted, Marvel or Star Wars, or I would imagine Harry Potter? Or
I really have to ask them what theirs is.
Okay.
You know, whenever they, you know, I really have to start there, you know, because if you are having faith conversations, you want to know what the person's, you know, framework is coming into the conversation. And so it does kind of matter what the overwhelming zeitgeist is at the moment, you know, and right now it's Marvel with the new Avengers film coming out in a month. And before that it was, you know, some conversations around Handmaid's Tale or, you know, something like that. So I think the interesting part about the internet culture now is that you can geek out over so many different topics, over so many different things. And so geek culture is not a marginal culture anymore. It's become much more mainstream. And that means it's also become less defined and more diffused. And so, you know, someone can geek out over a particular line of science fiction books, or they can geek out over Harry Potter. And so, I have ones that I'm really conversant in. I can talk about Star Wars and theology till the cows come home on whatever spaceship they'd be coming home on. or Harry Potter or some parts of Marvel and DC and Legend of Zelda, old Nintendo games, you know, I can riff on for a while. But it's really about talking with the other person, finding out what do you geek out about? And then if I am in the same genre or world, then yeah, we can definitely find connections. And if I'm not, then I ask about, you know, exactly what you did. Like, what is it? What is your favorite character in that? And, oh, that sounds, you know, kind of like Lando Calrissian from Star Wars or something like that.
So yeah.
I think the geek archetypes are found in all the different worlds. And so you can find those connections if you think about it.
Well, I will, at some other time, I'll have to connect you to my Star Wars loving son, and I'd love to hear him, have you converse with him. So another time.
Perhaps. Excellent. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Well, let's talk about the United Methodist Church and all of the things that's been happening the last few weeks. And because your blog is so popular, I'm imagining you're getting responses from all around the world, from all kinds of perspectives. Is it possible for you to summarize it all? are there, say, two or three dominant responses?
I will give my response perfectly. Okay. Or not perfect, personally, rather.
Okay.
So in my view, what happened at General Conference was a culmination of many years of efforts by folks who oppose LGBTQ inclusion in the church. And every 4 years, there, you know, the polity gets slightly more restrictive. They close more of the loopholes. They make it slightly more punitive against the portion of the Methodist Church that is trying to practice LGBTQ inclusion. And then that was, we were heading that direction in 2016 to really, you know, try to close off the last, try to close off as many as they could. And it was all sort of short-circuited by this effort to have the bishops lead us in a different way. And what ended up happening is that the bishops are not structured to lead us in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so we spent several years on a great group of people who did really great work, had great personal transformation, but they were unable to come together on a plan that would guide us forward into something different than what we had been. And so in the absence of the particular plan to prop up, and we vote up up or down, we ended up with the cattle call of several different plans. And even though we had lots of different ones, it really ended up being between the preferred one church plan, which would redistribute things, let annual conferences choose how they would practice LGBTQ inclusion or exclusion, and then the traditional plan, which just continued to close the loopholes. There were portions of the traditional plan that were novel and new and would have set Methodist Church on a new trajectory, but they were all they're all removed on the last day. And then the portions that remain are under judicial review, and they may not even be implemented at all. So my best description of General Conference 2019 was the fire festival, mm-hmm. you know, where it was a lot of money spent for something that did not change our conversations as much. With the one exception is that I think what happened is that the Middle Methodists and the Moderate Methodists, and especially the mega churches who try to play things safe, I think that they were awoken to the very real possibility that we are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that they hadn't personally invested before. Some of them have, for sure, but in a way of realizing that, you know, we are in danger of breaking this whole thing up in a very real way. And so I think that's what we're seeing right now. This is the longest answer probably you've ever imagined.
No, it's
that's what we're in the middle of right now. Yeah, that we have the Moderate and Middle Methodists are awoken to something, and they are trying to respond. But the question is it too late?
Yeah.
You know, has that ship sailed and we don't know yet?
That's my sense too, particularly with your observation about the moderate, especially moderate larger churches. And I'm wondering too, you had a post, I'm not sure how long ago it was, maybe it was a couple of years ago, when you compared denominations to dinosaurs, except in times of crisis.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, to kind of bring in my podcast theme of failure, are denominations still relevant? Or are they a failed way to do church in the 21st century?
You're asking a question, you know, I think people are asking a lot right now is, you know, we live in this
age. I'm hoping you have the answer.
we live in this age where institutions are not being valued, you know, where institutions are crumbling, where, you know, and free will affiliations are falling as well. Unless there's something in particular that grabs at people. And then we're also in this age of people being willing to go alone. You know, I like to talk about how the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly called the Mormons, and the Boy Scouts sort of ended their partnership this past year, even though it was mutual betterment for both of them. But the LDS Church decided that they could replicate everything that they got good from the Boy Scouts in their own way. And so they, you know, are taking their people and starting their own thing. And I think that's the temptation here in the Methodist Church, is that there's a temptation now to do exactly that, to say, we can do all these things that the institutional church is doing and do them better in our own way. And I think that there's a lot of caution around that, but there's also a lot of energy that can come from that. And so I think that right now, as far as your more general question about do denominations matter? I think that denominations I think we have relied too much on the Methodist Church as a denomination that protected something, that protected some gain or some effort or some ministry. And because they don't, instead of creating new things or standing for things, you know, the Methodist Church grew most. I like studying history. And the Methodist Church, you know, was on fire when it was starting new institutions, when it was starting seminaries and colleges and hospitals and, you know, really building things. That was when it was most on fire across America, is when they were creating institutions that delivered a public good. And we haven't been able to do that, or we haven't chosen to do that for a while. I think there are some efforts, you know, especially around disaster relief, Maginot malaria, even though that didn't raise the amount of money they had hoped, and, you know, other things like that. But if the denomination isn't creating tangible public good, then, you know, what are we doing? So I think that that's sort of a very ambiguous response to you, because if we're not creating something, then I feel like there's a sense of, well, let's just, you know, take our balls, go home, and create something ourselves.
So I guess what I'm hearing then, that there's still potential as long as they have the focus in the right places around, I like the way you say that, kind of creating things for the common good for our communities. Do you have a sense of, I mean, I can... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that some of those things are just gains that we've made. We're the largest church that ordains women, and we count it. And we have an agency that looks at how we're doing as far as that milestone. How will that organization continue if we split? You know, we try to be a racially and ethnically diverse denomination. And so we have, you know, religion and race that helps monitor and educate on that. You know, so there is because we're counting these things and we're monitoring these things, then they matter to the institution and to the church, to the local churches on some kind of scale. So if we, so there is something to be said for continuing those efforts so that we don't lose ground. You know, the other three largest denominations in America are the LDS Church, the Southern Baptist Church, and the Roman Catholic Church, none of which are friendly for women and women's equality. And so it's pretty bad Sophie's choice between supporting a denomination that falls short in so many different ways and perpetuates homophobia and violence, but, you know, lifts up women and women's experience in a way that no other denomination on this scale has. And then, you know, going and starting something new that may have that as their baseline, but will they actually count and monitor it in the ways that we do now?
Do you, drawing on your own description of yourself as a history buff, do you have a sense of I mean, I think people point to say the 50s is kind of a, as far as numerically, like that's the golden age when at the peak. Do you sense though, since, I mean, there's lots of reasons for decline, but do you sense that that was also the time when we stopped going, creating the things that matter and just resting on our laurels? Is that the time too, where you sense that we got kind of lethargic?
Very much, yes. I would. We were a reconstruction. We were trying to figure out what the world looked like after World War II. Baby boomers were being born. People were settling in and trying to recover. And I can't imagine what that was like to be part of the world at that time, where you were just trying. So much of the world was tossed upside down, and you were just trying to recover and recuperate. Turn things to something new. So I don't know what that means for us today, because we're also in this, you know, weird soup of the failures of capitalism and the rot and the increased scrutiny on the questions of oligarchy and all these different things around being a global economy also affect being a global church. And so I think that, the world events, really impact our local events. And I think there's one petition coming to General Conference that we change the year of General Conference to not be a presidential election year in America, because it is just... that so toxifies the conversation.
How are you on your blog? You're talking to a much broader scale, but how are you also communicating to your local church? You're the pastor of First UMC Seattle. And so I imagine there are some similarities in what you're communicating to the larger audience beyond, but then also talking to your own folks. So are there nuances in how you are talking to the people that you pastor to?
Yeah. I think for our local church is that I know who the people are, and I've only been here a year and a half, but that's been a pretty intense year and a half where we've started a three-year vision, a three-year goal last year, and we're just a very urban congregation that does lots of ministries around hunger and homelessness and around social advocacy. And so I think that when I talk about General Conference with them, it's mostly, these decisions that are made because we're in the Western jurisdiction, and the Western jurisdiction, top to bottom, has vertical agreement that we will not be enforcing the anti-gay portions of the discipline, that we operate as if they do not exist. And so anything passed by this General Conference doesn't affect us locally. But it definitely does affect us locally as far as, what we do with our money and whether people want to be members of a denomination that, have these sort of questions. So I think when I talk with my local church, I think there's a difference in speed. When I talk with my local church, I'm trying to encourage them that there are processes happening, and so we need to slow down and pray and discern and see what it is we're going to be doing. And we're going to work within our established processes. Mm. When I talk about it online, it is, guys, we've got to hurry up and get some stuff done and in. And, we've got annual conference legislation due dates. You've got elections this year for General Conference 2020.
Yeah.
We got to speed up. So I think that is probably the key difference, is that in the local church, we're going to be discerning this together because we have the privilege being in the West that we can slow down and figure out what this means for us ourselves. Whereas for my online audience and global audience, it is we've got to act now and come together and do things rather quickly because we're in unprecedented territory.
That's a wonderful encapsulation, I think, of our society today, in that we are so used to instantaneous results and responses and actions. And so in some ways, it's very goes against culture for you to tell your folks in your church, let's slow down and really discern, you know, where the Spirit might be leading us. So I guess, how do you see yourself and your voice in effecting change? Do you try to create change? And as you're calling people like, you know, friends, we need to make sure that we're moving on this. Or do you see yourself more as a place where people can gather and then they go out and effect the change?
The most formative aspect of how I see myself is that I'm from Oklahoma. I'm from the Bible Belt. I grew up in the Bible Belt, was commissioned and ordained in the Oklahoma Annual Conference. And then for family reasons, we moved out here to the West Coast, to the Western jurisdiction. And that was the biggest reframing of my life I had to do, that no longer was I going to be part of the progressive undercurrent in the Bible Belt, but I was going to be an outsider and being part of a majority progressive culture in the Western jurisdiction. And so that, you can call it guilt or you can call it solidarity maybe, is what guides me to write and to do things in ways that allow people in the Bible Belt and in the South, Southern jurisdictions to have conversations with their people. Because I'm able to say what they may not be able to say. And if I say it this way, then they can say, well, you know, I'm maybe not as far as Jeremy, but here's where I am. And it moves the needle just a little bit for them. So I see my mission is to try to, try to educate, you know, try to have every Methodist piece has some little esoteric piece of polity in there that I'm trying to help people understand. And sometimes I use outrage as a vehicle to do that. Sometimes I use just what the current event are. And sometimes I use different types of research or historical analysis to help frame things for people. But I'm always writing so that the people who are closest to the front lines, in the, you know, trying to change hearts and minds in the Bible Belt and in the South. And of course, you know, in our urban context, we have those too. In Chicago and in Seattle, we have those conversations too, but not at a level of risk to ourselves that happens in the Bible Belt and the South. So I think that a lot of what I write is to enable those folks to have the conversations and to do the education that they need in their contexts. And then if they need more, then they ask me and I put it out for people. You know, a lot of my work now is collaborations with folks in Bible Belt or Southern cultures to try to frame it in ways that are receptive to them. So, that, which means that, you know, I guess my next stage is to figure out, how to have those same collaborations with the worldwide church, with folks in Africa, folks in the Philippines. You know, and it's not as natural to me because I'm from the Bible Belt. And so having those connections and writing in collaboration, you know, is very natural to me. But that's certainly a growing edge for me going forward. And I think that for the church growing forward is, you know, how do we be a worldwide church if we only, you know, pay attention to the one mission project or one partnership that we have with a global community, and then every 4 years we wonder why we just don't understand each other.
And that also seems to be. I appreciate that philosophy that you have for your blog, because it seems. I mean, the tone of your blog does seem. I mean, certainly it makes a point, strong point, but underneath that, there does seem to be a tone of respect for one another, and so. In, you know, the times when I've read comments that folks go in, and it seems like there's a generally, correct me if I'm wrong, generally an air of civility about it, which these days people say don't even go bother going to the comments because it's a toxic mess. But do you feel like you've been able to do the opposite and create that online community where people can respect one another and be civil?
I think the thing about social media these days is that you create one piece of content and then it sits in multiple streams, either in a Facebook stream or a Twitter stream or even over on LinkedIn or an email conversation or just the comments on the blog itself. And I think that when the conversations are happening on Facebook, that they are slightly more civil because, you know, it's your name attached with your account. And so they're somewhat more civil. When it's on Twitter, it tends to be a little bit more no holds barred. And on the actual blog comments, because I don't censor them unless they're just really out of ground, people have accepted that those will be a little bit more on the nose, which is fine. But so I think the civility that you see is from longtime folks who keep on having the same conversations, and they're able to, you know, kind of go around with each other and anticipating the other person. But in other circles, it can be very combative. And I've had to write several times about how I deal with trolls and how I deal with caustic people online, because so many people will say, gosh, I just don't want to write something because I'm just going to get taken out by the community and by not my community, but by the online Methodist community, because it's very combative in places and at times. And so I'm trying to train people. How do you do that well? How do you talk well? And I think that is one area of ministry that I'm trying to be helpful with. In the West Coast, the first churches, their Sunday schools didn't teach the Bible. Their Sunday school classes taught English to immigrants, to folks who were coming in and working the frontier. And so their first job was to teach English, teach how to communicate. And I think that that's a role that churches and people who are online have to do now, too, is teach people how to communicate and how to wade into these combative situations and keep your integrity and your faith.
Did you imagine when you first started blogging that it would be where it is today?
No, not at all. I thought it would. It was really more of I'm an extrovert and I don't do diaries for myself. And so I would write a diary or things I'm thinking about for other people to see.
Yeah.
And so that went to communicate with and talk. And so I'd never thought that it would be, you know, that I'd get emails from bishops who are reading it. And there's a bishop in Europe who apparently sends all my stuff to people. So, yeah, I never imagined. And then I get comments from folks in Africa and questions about how to do various things. And I'm trying to connect them with the resources I know of. And so I never imagined being a hub for this type of conversation. You know, if it was just me opining out there, yeah, I probably saw that. But as far as being a hub and a connecting force, I that's certainly a surprise, but something I'm really thankful for. And it connects me to people like you who also do your ministry of connection and of asking people the questions that lead to hopefully a different answer for us all.
Well, and I'm gonna butcher this. So for the geeks who are listening, I'm gonna butcher this quote, and so folks can have at it. But it reminds, there's a little bit of the Spider-Man, you know, with great strength comes great responsibility.
So you got it right.
With a wider audience, it's more than just you opining, but it's bigger than that.
Yeah. And it's very Wesleyan. You know, I am accountable to my community. Mm. And so if I step out, they let me know. And some folks, if they're just there to troll and to criticize, then I don't need to listen to them. But if they are, you know, authentically there and they have a concern, you know, then they talk with me about it. You know, I had a 1-hour chat with another clergy person, you know, about how there was something I was doing that wasn't helpful. You know, and because I valued that clergy person, you know, then I was able to hold that that commentary a little differently. So I think that, you know, it you can be Wesleyan online and by creating a community of folks who don't, you know, who they may call you out in public or they may call you out in private, but It's important that you keep up that humility in yourself, and ask the other person to have humility that they might be wrong as well. So, yeah.
Well, let me ask you a very general question, and I would imagine you get asked this too from folks in your local church and also online. But is there hope, or are you hopeful when looking for the future, not just of United Methodism, but I guess of Christianity?
I am. I'm going to delve into a post I haven't written yet, but it's coming. I was listening to an audiobook called Hitmakers. It's about the science of popularity. Mm. And one of the chapters there talked about how so many of the top songs have a similar beat, or they steal different riffs from each other. And so there's not too much difference from them, between them as far as musically. And it said that, that there's a familiarity that if you change just one thing, then you're okay. You're still within the familiar genre and people will like your music. But if you change too much, then it doesn't connect with people in a different way. Mm. So I think that we are in, as far as global, the whole Christian conversation, that we are in a point where I think progressive Christianity has really strong footing. Because if you were, when the world was much more Christian, asking them to reframe, like 10 or 12 different things that progressives do differently, that was a hard sell. And people, when they come from a Christian worldview, to move away from what is familiar in 10 different ways rather than one, is really difficult. But with the rise of the nuns and with folks who don't have a faith background or have walked away from a faith background for a long time, I think when they do come back and when they do interact with the religious left or progressive Christianity, that the things that are different don't bother them as much because they weren't familiar in the first place. Mm. And what is familiar are the valuing of people equally and of social justice that they see in society, or at least sought out in society, but they don't see it in the church as much. And so I think that the future for progressive Christianity is good because of folks don't have to unlearn as much to understand to understand progressive Christianity, but also the countercultural aspects of it, of course. Mm. Now, as far as the United Methodist Church, I was interviewed by a different publication that said, with the younger generations being more inclusive of LGBTQ persons, is there hope? What's the hope for the Methodist Church changing? And my answer is that I don't have hope for the United Methodist Church to become more affirming anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I do have a lot of hope that we can live into that we are a global church of different regions, and the different regions can be more inclusive because of our structure, that the central conferences can choose to be more inclusive, and the different jurisdictions to a lesser degree can choose to be more inclusive, especially the North and the West, banding together and sharing resources and sharing accountability, that they can sustain themselves against any changes that are sought by those who are more less inclusive. Mm. But the question is that enough to inspire us to create something new from within the church, or must we do it outside the church? And that's a question that I think we're wrestling with, at least for the next year and 2 months until General Conference 2020.
Yeah. So. Well, I appreciate that insight. I end every conversation by asking the same question. And usually I give people a heads up, and I didn't give you a heads up. So,
oh, good.
My apologies for that. But I always ask people to end by sharing a failure story. a time where they really messed up. And that can be anything personal, professional. It can be something that you did this morning, something that you did when you had a lousy lemonade stand when you're five. You know, kind of leave it open.
I think my failures are around this shift that we just talked about from being one person's voice to being a hub. Is that as the volume of connections and requests and things come in, that I can't respond to them all. And I've hurt people by not responding to them, by not being helpful in a time when they needed it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that my more recent failures have been an inability to scale my online ministry in a way that continues to be helpful to everybody. And so there's that phrase of, for a local church, you know, that don't be a church, for everybody, be a church for somebody. Mm. I think I might be butchering that one as well. That's something around that where, I have to, at times choose to be a online ministry for some people and not mm-hmm. for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I wish it was the other way so that I didn't fall short, in various ways. And I think that some of that is just growing pains. But it's something that I am fully equipped as a pastor and as an extrovert to be able to handle, you know, most of the requests that come my way, just like I do in a local church. But there are people that fall through and that I've caused harm. And so I'm trying to learn to live into that a little bit better. That's my hot take failure story. I'm sure I'll come up with 18 better ones for a follow-up conversation.
Okay. Well, it's your hot take being human too.
There you go. There you go.
Well, Jeremy, I really appreciated the conversation, and I'll put all the links so folks can find you on various channels. And thanks again for giving me your time today.
Well, thanks a lot, Christian, for you and your ministry and the ways that you connect people across time and space and pixels and whatever sound is made out of, sound waves.
So, all right.
God's blessings to you and your ministry.
Thanks so much. And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Jeremy for giving his time for this conversation. Jeremy's website is hackingchristianity.net, and you can find him on Twitter at @umjeremy. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast, as in our next episode, we'll remember Dietrich Bonhoeffer. April is the month where, in 1945, the German theologian, pastor, and dissident was killed in a Nazi POW camp. We'll talk to Dr. Reggie Williams, who wrote the book Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus. And to learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.